I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome to Radio Times. Earlier this year, David Guggenheim witnessed an oil spill in the South Atlantic Ocean that wreaked environmental havoc on a remote island. He's also been one of the few Americans to dive in the Queen's Garden off the coast of Cuba to see an underwater world that he said was like Jurassic Park. He told NPR that he and other scientists saw species they thought were extinct. David Guggenheim is a marine scientist, a submarine pilot, and an ocean explorer. He's a senior fellow at the Ocean Foundation, and he joins us on Radio Times to talk about the state of the Earth's oceans and his underwater adventures. And David Guggenheim, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much. It's great to be with you.
Great to have you with us. Well, we know that the oceans cover about 70% of the Earth's surface. Is there a way to actually assess the health of the Earth's oceans?
Well, that's part of my job, and people like me, is to go out and sample the ocean and see what's going on out there. But the oceans are so big and so vast, it's really a challenge. And believe it or not, we have only explored about 5% of the world's oceans. Incredible. It's been said that we know more about the backside of the moon than we do about the bottom of the oceans. And if you think about it, if you're trying to take data in the oceans, you're on a research boat, which goes about the speed of a bicycle.
Right.
And think about all that territory you've got to cover. And that's just in two dimensions, not to mention getting down to the interesting places deep down.
When you talk about data or samples, it literally is, I mean, the parts of the ocean that you have sampled is just looking at the quality of the water, the makeup of the water, what you see.
Some of it is actually visual, just to get in the water and look around, take video, and then to start quantifying it, to turn those observations into numbers using video sampling techniques and actually sampling where you're pulling up specimens and looking at them in a more analytical way. But it's a slow, tedious process.
So we've looked at, or you've looked at about 5% of the Earth's oceans. What can you tell us?
Well, I haven't looked at nearly that
much.
Are
you and your fellow marine scientists?
Well, the oceans are, unfortunately, in great trouble. And that can come as a great surprise to people because the oceans seem so vast and so big that how could we, puny little humans, have much impact on it? But in fact, we have, over the years, and especially the last 50 years, engineered tremendous changes in the oceans. For example, we have eliminated about 90% of the ocean's predators, the predatory fish, that is. So fish,
sharks
and swordfish, tuna, for example. So that comes as a surprise to people, and it's hard to imagine that we could have taken that many fish out of the oceans. But in fact, fish stocks around the world are collapsing, and our appetite is still not satiated.
And what's the chain reaction of that? If you take most of the predators out of the ocean, what happens to other fish, other marine life?
Well, we forget sometimes that the oceans aren't a fish farm, per se. It's not like we harvest crops that we've planted out there. Fish are wild animals. We're still hunting wild animals in the oceans. So that's one part of it. But the other is they've got jobs to do. Fish are part of the ecosystem. They're part of that fabric, and they all have important jobs. There are some fish that graze coral reefs. They eat the algae and keep those corals nice and clean so that they can thrive. Sharks are very important. And in fact, I think now we have an even greater appreciation for the role of sharks and top predators to keep ecosystems healthy.
Would you say then don't eat predator fish? I mean, would that be a good place to start?
That would be a great place to start. I know that's difficult for many of us who've tuned our appetites. I used to eat all of those fish, and I've stopped eating most of those big predatory fish, and I've started eating lower on the food chain. Sardines, for example, they're low in mercury, and they taste good. They're good for you, high in omegas.
Do you see the effect of climate change? I mean, when you look at oceans and we hear about ocean rise, for instance, and people are certainly reporting ocean rise, does that also affect the quality of ocean water?
Very much so. This is one of the biggest concerns globally in the oceans today. Not only the transfer of heat and the changes that are taking place, the oceans moderate our climate, and that's very important, but also especially the effect on coral reef environments. Now, the future of coral reefs is really hanging in the balance right now. About 25% of the world's reefs are already gone, and there's nothing we can do about that right now because the trend is in the wrong direction. And if we don't take any actions, we're going to lose another 25% in the next couple of decades or so. And a lot of that has to do with a warming climate. Corals are animals. They're colonial animals. That what you see is a whole bunch of them living together, and the calcium carbonate is the skeleton, this shell-like, this hard substance. They can't tolerate high temperatures, and they're already living up near their upper tolerance for warm water. But climate change also has an evil twin called ocean acidification. And the same carbon dioxide that we're pumping out on from our tailpipes and from our power plants, that carbon dioxide dissolves with seawater. Forgive me a little bit of chemistry, CO2 plus H2O forms carbonic acid, H2CO3. And that acid is eating away at anything with a calcium carbonate shell. And if you think about it, that's a lot of stuff in the oceans. That's everything from crabs and scallops to the very base of the food chain. Many of the little plankton that form the base of the food chain have calcium carbonate shells. So the threat of acidification, our oceans are becoming more and more acid, may be as much, it may rival the effects of climate change.
So do you worry about the future of our oceans, as vast as they are?
I'm desperately worried.
Are you?
I've seen tremendous changes. I learned to dive when I was 15, and my eyes, I can still feel how wide they were when I went to the Florida Keys when I was still 15 and saw a coral reef for the first time. And sadly, you go back to those places, and it's not even a fraction of what it used to be. We've lost 95% of some of the species of coral, Elkhorn coral, which was this incredible species of coral, is almost gone from much of the Caribbean.
You have written about some of your underwater explorations, and I want you to describe to our listeners, this is, a solo submarine. And you have gone to some amazing places of the world, including deep below the Bering Sea. First of all, describe this submarine for our listeners.
This is about as small a submarine as one can build. They're built by Nutco, N-U-Y-T-C-O, up in Vancouver, a genius named Phil Newton, who's also a good friend. And there are two subs, the Deep Rover, which you may have seen in the movie The Abyss.
Oh, sure.
And the Deep Worker, which is even smaller than the Deep Rover. And the idea is, as Sylvia Earle, the oceanographer, would say, these are so easy, even a scientist could fly them. They are really a new generation of submarine. First of all, it is easy. It's very simple. But it's a pressurized hull, so you are always at the surface pressure. You don't feel any change in pressure as you go down, which means you don't have to worry about the effects of decompression sickness or the bends. It is all electrical. You fly with your feet in the Deep Worker.
Talking about flying underwater.
Flying underwater. Right. No tether to the surface. You're all alone, an acrylic dome, and you can go down to 2,000 feet in the Deep Worker, 3,000 feet in the Deep Rover, and it recirculates the air just the way a spacecraft does, has carbon dioxide scrubbers. So you can stay down for up to 3 days if you had to. You wouldn't really want to. There's no restroom. But
Well, that's interesting.
You a typical dive is around 4 to 6 hours or so.
So you can go deeper and stay longer.
Yes.
With these little baby submarines.
Yes, and it's an amazing platform to do research from, to go down deep. And even, you know, if you think about it, most of the world underwater that we've seen is where we can scuba dive to, which is 100 feet or less. So even to get to 200, 300, 500 feet is extraordinary, let alone a couple thousand feet. But even that is just a fraction of the depth of the deepest part of the ocean.
Well, let me quote you. And this is when you went a one-person submarine beneath the Bering Sea. You went about 1,300 feet under, and you describe it's freezing cold, completely dark and forbidding, and it's utterly beautiful. I've seen deep sea corals at nearly 2,000 feet defiantly wearing their brilliant pink colors across a dark brown and gray seascape. Some of the corals may be as old as 2,000 years.
That's right.
So the idea of seeing something pink so deep in the ocean.
It's so beautiful. I consider that one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen. And corals can actually live even older than 2,000 years. I found out later one of my colleagues that they can live up to 4,000 years old and still be alive. That's a pretty old animal. That expedition was actually in partnership with Greenpeace, doing science. We weren't hanging banners. We were doing science. Great team up there aboard the Esperanza. And the reason we were there was because those corals, which we're just finding now in these deep depths, they're different from the ones that you find in the more temperate waters, but absolutely beautiful and very important to the ecosystem. Those corals are being destroyed at an alarming rate by fish trawlers, and a trawl is a net that drags along the bottom and it destroys everything in its path and catches much more than just the fish that they are trying to catch. So the idea was to go up and map those areas, document the presence of those corals, and hopefully change the practices.
We're almost up on a break here, but you describe seeing prehistoric-looking fish patrolling the dark waters of these depths, seeing hungry, voracious squid. This is the sort of world that we don't get to see.
Yes, and I was giggling like a kid because for the first time, being down at 2,000 feet, I was seeing those childhood books, the illustrations come alive, and it was an absolutely incredible experience.
And that's David Guggenheim, our guest today on Radio Times. He's an ocean explorer, a marine scientist, a submarine pilot, a senior fellow at the Ocean Foundation, where he directs the Cuba Marine Research and Conservation Program. And we invited him to join us today on Radio Times while he is in Philadelphia receiving an award from the International Exploration Society, also speaking tomorrow at a public lecture at the Friends Select School. The award he is receiving is about his scientific research on coral reefs, which we were just talking about. Any questions or comments for our guest? Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. The musicians will take their seats. Chief Conductor Charles Dutoit will raise his baton. And the Philadelphia Orchestra will begin the new season with Ravel's Bolero. Also, Dawn Upshaw sings songs of George Gershwin, Stephen Sondheim, and Leonard Bernstein. Tickets at 215-893-1999. Online at philorc.org. This Thursday at the Kimmel Center, opening night with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
At the heart of everything we do at WHYY is one thing, storytelling. We try to inform, engage, inspire, and connect through deep, colorful stories. And NewsWorks Tonight brings together the best reporting from our network of journalists in one smart, lively regional news magazine. Weeknights at 6 on WHYY-FM, or listen online at WHYY.org and NewsWorks.org. There's also the podcast, and you can follow NewsWorks Tonight on Twitter and Facebook. And that's the story.
Supporting WHYY, Westchester University offers over 150 undergraduate and graduate programs, including a computer science degree certified by the National Security Agency, nationally accredited business programs, and research opportunities like the Liquid Life Laboratory. More details are available online at wcupa.edu. That's online at wcupa.edu.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with David Guggenheim about the state of the Earth's oceans and his underwater adventures. And again, we are taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. I do want to get to things like oil spills and things that we must talk about. But another thing you have done, and I don't know how many Americans have gotten to do this, which is to dive off the coast of Cuba. And this is a place called the Queen's Garden. First of all, describe this garden and how did it come to be?
Well, I am very lucky. I've been working in Cuba for 11 years now. I just returned from my 58th trip, if I'm counting correctly. And scientific research is one of the permitted activities. You need a license from the U.S. Department of Treasury and all sorts of other paperwork. But we've been working with the University of Havana on research, primarily in Cuba's Gulf of Mexico waters, but we are now expanding to the south in an area called Jardines de la Reina, the Gardens of the Queen, and that was named by Christopher Columbus for Queen Isabel because it was so beautiful. And I first dove there 2 years ago and absolutely did have that Jurassic Park feeling. It was like rolling the clock back 500 years to see what Columbus would have seen if he were a scuba diver. I don't think he was.
No.
But it was amazing to me to see the healthiest coral reef I've ever seen and all of the animals present. It was like the original cast was there, the corals, the sharks, everywhere. I've never been in the water with so many sharks, but that we know is a sign of a healthy ecosystem.
Now, this is a part of the ocean about 380 square miles, something like that. But fishing has been banned there. Do you think that's the reason for the health that you saw?
Without a doubt. When we fish, we tend to go for those big fish. And to see these big, beautiful sharks and grouper and Goliath grouper and other species able to get big and to, again, do their jobs in the ecosystem, that couldn't happen if there were fishing. And this came about, this is a protected area about 15 years ago. And they worked with the local fishermen who were fishing that area and said, you know, we think we can make more money on tourism than we can fishing. And they promised all of the fishermen jobs working in the tourist industry in that area. And they turned it into an underwater park, a protected area. And I tell people, if you want to see if protecting an area works, if setting up marine reserves, marine parks, whatever you want to call them, works, just stick your head underwater there for 5 minutes and you'll be convinced. It was amazing. And it protects all aspects of that ecosystem together. That's the beauty of it.
But does it tell us that in 14 or 15 years that an area can return to its original self?
I think it does tell us that. Now, admittedly, that area probably wasn't nearly as degraded as other areas around the world, but there is hope, and many of us have been very depressed. I know that the first part of our conversation was kind of depressing and talking about some of these trends. It's not a pretty thing, but the oceans are incredibly resilient. You give them a chance, and they will come right back. The problem is we're not doing that. The Cuban government has made a commitment to protecting 25% of their ocean waters in some form of certainly to restrict fishing. In contrast, we have protected less than 1% and no long-term commitment at all. And this is part of the problem. That's about the same number globally. If you look at worldwide, if you're a fish, how much of the ocean can you can you hang out in without risk of being fished out? It's about 1%. And we really need to increase that number. On land, we've protected in this country about 14-15% of our lands in some sort of protection. In the water, it's a very low number.
And have tourists come to help support the fishermen?
Absolutely. I think responsible, sustainable tourism is part of the answer. I absolutely believe that that's going to be part of the answer, and that shark is worth a whole lot more alive than it is on somebody's dinner plate.
Well, I began by describing very briefly this oil spill in the South Atlantic Ocean, and you happened to be nearby as this was going on. In fact, this was earlier this year.
This was one of these strange events where everything was improbable, including my unwitting involvement right in the middle of it. I was lecturing aboard a passenger ship, a small exploration ship, and we were a day ahead of schedule leaving South Georgia Island and heading for a tiny speck that probably nobody's ever heard of called Tristan da Cunha. It is the most remote inhabited island in the world, a little volcano popping up out of the South Atlantic. But Mother Nature did a funny thing down there. She decided to entrust about half of the, at least the second highest number of seabirds in the world in that island chain, because it's so remote and so far from humanity and just rich waters. Incredible numbers of rockhopper penguins and albatross and prions and shearwaters. It's just absolutely breathtaking. I've never seen so many birds filling the air as I have there. Absolutely incredible. But we were a day ahead of schedule heading up to Tristan da Cunha and got a distress call. A Greek freighter carrying soybeans from Brazil to Singapore had run aground on the neighboring island, Nightingale Island, and needed our help. And we just happened to be a day ahead of schedule, and we just happened to have Zodiacs aboard, the inflatable boats that can, in high seas, and these were very high seas in this area, come right up against the hull of another boat and are ideal for rescuing people. And it turned out that our expedition team rescued the crew from the ship, and within about 8 to 12 hours later, that ship split in half. And I don't see how there couldn't have been loss of life. But that's where the story begins, because that ship was carrying soybeans, so it sounds no big deal. But its fuel was 300,000 gallons of heavy marine oil. And it's a absolutely stunning example of how a ship doesn't have to be a super tanker to create a huge environmental disaster.
Was it a disaster for the island and these birds that you described?
Absolute disaster, because this oil was delivered right to the doorstep of some of the most important bird areas, bird rookeries in the world, including these rockhopper penguins. And if you watch Happy Feet, you know, the one with the kind of looks like a punk penguin with the feathers in its hair. Amazing birds, hardy birds, but they come ashore twice a year, once to nest and once to molt, where they change their feathers. And while they're molting, they're miserable. They can't eat because their food's in the water. They just want to get back in the water. And that's when the oil happens. So you have thousands of penguins in a population that's already declined 90% over the last 50 years. All penguin species are not doing that well. Suddenly covered with oil as they make their way back into the water. And many of them died. And I finally got ashore, knocked on the door of the head of the local, and there are only 300 people on this island, so, you know, this American from Washington, D.C. knocking on the door offering to help. I mean, it's all very surreal.
Yes.
But there really wasn't that much we could do. It was so frustrating. There's no airstrip on this island. The nearest major civilization is 1,500 miles away by boat, Cape Town, South Africa, 5 to 7 day boat ride. But we launched a major campaign to try to help save these penguins. They did what they could. They converted the public swimming pool into a rehab center.
And I've seen pictures of that, yeah, filled with penguins.
Yes, but many, many of them died. And we won't know the true impact until a few weeks from now, as these penguins are coming back right now as we speak to nest. I'm hoping to get back there next year to assess the situation, but it's just another example of how what we do, this was a brand new ship, and nobody knows how this could have happened. But interestingly, there was another vessel carrying soybeans that nobody's ever heard of, the Selendang IU, in the Bering Sea in the along the Aleutian chain. And this was in 2004. It's the second largest oil spill in Alaska, and nobody's heard of it.
Well, that's David Guggenheim, our guest today on Radio Times. He is an ocean explorer. He's a marine scientist, a submarine pilot, a senior fellow at the Ocean Foundation, where he directs the Cuba Marine Research and Conservation Program. Joining us today on Radio Times, talking about some of his underwater adventures and to talk about the state of the world's oceans. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Sharon from Manhattan to join us. And Sharon, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thank you so much, Marty.
You're
and
welcome.
David. I appreciate the opportunity. I was looking at the website that NOAA has, their Seafood Watch, and I looked at the predator species that you were talking about earlier, and I saw that all of them are not overfished, and I'm wondering why you're telling us that we should be eating these fish.
Fair
if
enough.
They are, in fact, at the NOAA website, that's National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration, why exactly we shouldn't be eating.
Fair enough. And I think we're losing you on your phone there, Sharon, but go ahead, David Guggenheim.
Well, the 90% figure that I used is a global figure, but it does apply to many species here at home. The NOAA site is focused on our domestic fish stocks. Some are better managed than others, but I still feel strongly that these are animals that we need to give them a break. And if you think about it, fish like sardines reproduce very quickly. Mahi-mahi is another good choice, tasty fish. It reproduces well. It's well managed. But if you're a shark, and here along the East Coast, many of us know the dogfish. It's a shark, and there's actually been a fishery for that fish. But if you think about its life history, it has a gestation period about the same length as the African elephant. It's months and months, much longer than ours, almost 2 years. And then once they do give birth, they only give birth to about 6 pups, and they don't mature sexually until the age of 13. So if we're fishing heavily on these stocks, that can be a very big problem. Of course, the other issue here is one of health. Human health. We've all heard about mercury in seafood, and that's a concern. And I've known a surprising number of colleagues and friends who've ended up with mercury poisoning just by eating tuna. And if you think about the food chain, it makes sense. These chemicals absorb in the fatty tissue of animals, and they concentrate on their way up the food chain. So the predators have the most amount of this of heavy metals like mercury, for example. And of course, that's coming from power plant emissions. That's mercury from coal. Air pollution turns into water pollution, and it gets absorbed up in plankton and ends up in our own bodies. So it's another reason not to eat big fish, but it is a good question. I think it's very hard to do the right thing. There are some great tools for folks. There's apps for that. You can get the Monterey Bay Aquarium seafood card. Blue Ocean Institute has a fish phone which is a great app as well. And the third I really like is Food and Water Watch, which is a consumer organization in Washington, D.C. I've done a lot of work with them, and they have their version of it. But I'll tell you, it's hard to do the right thing.
Well, Sharon, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And again, you can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. I know you have written some articles about what's described as land-based aquaculture. And aquaculture was at least originally designed to deal with this problem of overfishing. But we have found that there have been some, I guess, environmental costs or price to that. So what is land-based aquaculture?
You know, you mentioned the word aquaculture or fish farming, and people in my field tend to have almost a visceral negative reaction because aquaculture has gotten a very bad name, and with good reason. You look at the way it's been practiced. We put typically net pens, nets in the water where we grow fish, but they're sitting in the natural environment with lots of waste coming out. Sometimes these fish escape and mix with the wild populations. You've got in British Columbia a terrible situation of Atlantic salmon being grown in the Pacific, and many of them are escaping, and the captive populations are infecting the wild populations with parasites and disease. So One of the things that I think maybe the environmental community hasn't been doing enough of is looking at aquaculture more seriously, because if you think about it, we are eating wild animals in the ocean, and it's not going to feed us indefinitely. Aquaculture has to be part of the solution if we want to eat seafood. So a few years ago, I had one of those moments where you just say, wow, that is an incredible concept, and wondered why this wasn't mainstream. And this is land-based aquaculture, and it's much like the urban farming that's going on right now. These are farms that can be anywhere. You can grow fish in Kansas if you want. You don't need an ocean nearby. They look like a warehouse from the outside. They recirculate 99% of their water. No chemicals or antibiotics. So by some measures, you're growing an organic fish. And I've eaten fish from these systems over in Malaysia and seen these systems in operation in Denmark. The rest of the world is way ahead of us. And I think this is the future.
And do you need to grow the right kind of fish in one of these fish tanks, so to speak?
You can grow just about anything in these in these tanks, but of course you do want to grow something that is that the market wants and that is sustainable as well. But if you think about it, it takes about a week or so for that fish to get to your refrigerator, even if it's called fresh fish right now. This is fish you can grow in your community, and it can be in your frying pan in minutes. And I've seen that in Malaysia, where they just pack it in ice and deliver it to restaurants within a few minutes. And chefs like it very much.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation and our callers. David Guggenheim is our guest, and he is an ocean explorer, a marine scientist, a submarine pilot, a senior fellow at the Ocean Foundation. He's receiving an award for his scientific research on coral reefs from the International Exploration Society in Philadelphia. That's today. And obviously joining us today on Radio Times, 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
1812 Productions, Philadelphia's all-comedy theater company, supports WHYY. 1812 Productions presents Mistakes Were Made, the newest comedy from Craig Wright, writer for 6 Feet Under and United States of Terra. Starring Barrymore Award winner Scott Greer, this fast-paced comedy shows us an afternoon in the life of a Broadway producer who turns the theater world on its ear when he decides to make art instead of money. Mistakes Were Made, now on stage through October 30th. Tickets at 1812productions.org.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. The Occupy Wall Street movement has now spread to other cities. What do protesters want? Also, teaching foreign-born doctors how to treat patients in Iowa, including classes on how to talk about the Hawkeyes and farming. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Morristown Friends School proudly supports WHYY and is hosting an admissions open house on Sunday, October 23rd at 2 p.m. Founded in 1785, Morristown Friends offers rigorous academics coupled with a spiritual and ethical education program for students in preschool through grade 12. More information, multimedia, and all open house dates can be found online at mfsopportunities.org. mfsopportunities.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, again talking with David Guggenheim about the state of the world's oceans and some of his underwater experiences and adventures. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me ask about the Gulf of Mexico, and it's about a year and a half since the BP Horizon I'm not sure if spill is exactly the right word, but nonetheless, we know what happened. But you've also written about the dead zones, or the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, the size of New Jersey. But this is runoff from agriculture and from people's lawns. I mean, this really predates what happened with BP and Horizon.
It really does. There was focus on the dead zone because of the amount of natural gas that was coming out of that hole with the oil, which can basically fertilize the oceans the way nutrient pollution does. And let me describe what nutrient pollution really is.
Sure.
If we fertilize our lawns, which unfortunately we all tend to do, we have to have our lawn greener than the next guys, that much of that fertilizer runs off and runs into our streams. And if you look at the continental United States, you see that about 40% or more of the continent drains into the Gulf of Mexico. Even a little bit of Canada drains into the Gulf of Mexico. And of course, it drains through the breadbasket of the continent, the agricultural areas, where we see even more fertilizers being used, industrial-grade fertilization going on. And when those nutrients that are used to fertilize plants and crops and lawns make their way down the Mississippi and out into the Gulf, they do the same thing in the water that they do on your lawn or on a farm. They make plants grow. They help promote the growth of plants and algae in the water. And when those plants and algae die, bacteria go to work, and those bacteria need oxygen. And it basically sucks all of the oxygen out of the water when those plants are being decomposed, and very little else can live there. And that's why they call it a dead zone, because it's pretty much dead to anything but those bacteria. And
how is that huge. Is it possible to bring back to life? I mean, I guess you have to change agriculture and what people put on their lawns.
Exactly. I wrote an article said if you want to help the Gulf of Mexico, kill your lawn. But I mean that only half in jest, because if you look around, I spent many years in Florida. One of the worst things in Florida is the fact that they're using all of this water that is precious to the health of the Everglades, for example, to water lawns that don't belong there. And there's a program called Florida Yards and Neighborhoods, and there are analogs of that program in other states to help teach people how to use native vegetation and come up with a beautiful front yard that's more natural and doesn't need any mowing or maintenance or fertilizer.
Let me get some callers into the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. We have Sandy from Montgomery County joining us on Radio Times. And Sandy, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
This is a very interesting program.
Thank you. You're doing
some very interesting and I think important work. I'm curious about your background. How did you get to this point in your career, and how did you choose this career? Are you a marine biologist, an oceanographer?
All good questions, Sandy. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. Go ahead, Dave.
Well, I actually grew up here in Philadelphia, born and raised, and went to the Jersey Shore, and I went fishing with my dad, and I loved the ocean the way he did, and he's the one that really helped me fall in love with it. But I also must confess to watching too much TV as a kid, and I know that's kind of a common
thing. Well, you are forgiven after all, but go ahead.
But Lloyd Bridges was there, Sea Hunt reruns, and it captivated me. And it's funny because I was more interested in the gear and the adventure than I was in biology. But once you get involved, you can't help but deal with the biology and the conservation issues. But anyway, for my 15th birthday, I begged my parents for scuba diving lessons. So I took them at the Abington Y and ended up going to an amazing summer camp called Sea Camp in the Florida Keys, which is still there, seacamp.org. And it is a marine science curriculum. It teaches you scuba diving. And that's really what sealed my fate, was living that dream.
Sandy, thanks for calling into Radio Times. And David, we were talking about this before we went on the air, but your dad actually disappeared at sea. I guess you were about 18 years old.
Yeah.
And he was off the coast of what?
Of Cape May. Of Cape May. On our boat, and he was fishing alone. And the Cape May Loose Ferry captain spotted the boat going in circles, and nobody aboard. They never did find him. It was a terrible tragedy. And he was only 49, to make things even worse. It was a sobering reminder that the ocean is a very dangerous place. You've got to be very careful. He was out alone and may have just slipped off. It was November. It was cold. But it's also obviously not stopped me. It's given me a more humble appreciation, but I know he would be happy that I'm pursuing the love that he gave me of the oceans. And I turned 50 a couple of years ago, and it was strange to outlive my father, but in part to honor his memory and his love of the oceans, I did something kind of strange on one's 50th birthday. Instead of jumping out of a plane or having a big party, I launched an expedition, in quotes, to all 50 states and U.S. territories to bring the message of the oceans and science to kids at school. So I'm now, this is my visit to Philadelphia as part of that journey. I visited 17 states plus one U.S. territory so far, and it's been an amazing journey.
And was his love for the ocean as a quote-unquote amateur?
Yes. Yes, he was a fisherman. Amateur fisherman. But I felt like when we were out together on the water, that was the one place where, kind of like a captive audience, we just connected, and we loved it, and he taught me how to navigate, he taught me how to fish, he taught me, you know, all those things that I still love.
Let me get, looks like Martha from Lower Gwinnett to join us, and Martha, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead, you're on the air.
Yes, I was just wondering, you mentioned about people's lawns contributing to these dead zones in the Gulf of Mexico. I had understood that the corn industry, which is just so absurdly huge, and was the one that was really pouring huge amounts of fertilizer into the Gulf.
And Martha, I have to say, David Guggenheim is nodding his head, yes?
Yeah, I guess you need to talk on the radio,
no, that's
not
okay.
Just
I'm
nod.
Here to translate,
well,
so that's fine.
I appreciate that. Yes, absolutely. You're absolutely right. And if you look at the number of nutrients coming from industrial agriculture, it's much, much higher than that coming from residential lawns. But I mention that as something back, if you think about the oil spill, people were frustrated that they couldn't do more. And I was trying to come up with some ideas of ways people could help that could make a difference. And it's not just the Gulf that those lawns are impacting. It's their waterways that go through their communities and their rivers and all of the rest. And it's a good practice.
Well, and I'm thinking of all those impervious surfaces too, which just sort of help it make the runoff do what it does.
That's right. We've turned what used to be slow moving water into fast-moving water because this water has no place to go now. And that's been a big problem, too. We've got these huge pulses of fresh water. And if you're a little critter trying to make a living and these big pulses of fresh water come along, that can ruin your day.
Martha, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. We are talking about our oceans and ocean literacy. And again, our guest is David Guggenheim, 1-888-477-9499. You have been working with Cuban scientists, as you said, for more than a decade now. And this is where it gets very, very interesting, which is that Cuba wants to do some oil drilling off their coast. We know about the relationship between the United States and Cuba. You have been involved in this in point of fact, because we need to have some kind of cooperation on this, and yet we've got two countries that view each other as enemies, in a sense.
We had kind of a dry run of this last year during the Gulf spill. And the irony was, there's been all this talk about Cuba drilling and its impact on us, but for a few weeks, it looked like oil from the Deepwater Horizon was going to impact Cuba. We may all remember those models that were showing the oil going up the east coast of the U.S., and the current regime changed at the last minute, but we held a meeting in Washington. I organized a meeting, and we had State Department, Coast Guard, and others on the phone in Washington and in Havana, all really great, enthusiastic about helping and doing the right thing should the worst happen, but really kind of flummoxed that we didn't have we had no dialogue going. We had no coordinated emergency response plan. They didn't have good contacts. And we've been building contacts over the last 11 years. And I've helped put together something called the Tri-National Initiative that also includes Mexico to help elevate research and conservation to a new level. Now the focus is on this platform that is on its way from China
to Cuba.
And we've got Repsol, a Spanish company, involved in drilling, and Norway is involved. So everybody but us is basically involved, Vietnam, Malaysia. And the models show that about 90% of an oil spill, of a major blowout, would end up in the Florida Keys and up the east coast of Florida. And that's where the currents take it. So many of us have been saying, we need to have a dialogue. I actually raised this issue back in 2004 when oil was first discovered. We at least have to have a dialogue. And I was delighted to see that the President's Commission on the BP oil spill, co-chaired by former EPA Administrator Bill Riley and former Florida Governor and Senator Bob Graham, includes mention of Cuba in its report, saying we have to work together on international safety standards to make a rational policy for the Gulf of Mexico. So recently, Bill Riley did go to Cuba with our colleagues at Environmental Defense Fund, and we hope to continue that dialogue and try to help be the honest brokers in the middle, I guess. It's just hard for a government to work with another government where there are no diplomatic relations. But look, we all have neighbors we don't get along with, but you got to figure out how to work with them if your neighborhood is at risk.
Let me get another caller. We have, it looks like Richard from West Philadelphia joining us on Radio Times. And Richard, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
I know you brought up the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico several times. I wanted to know, are they measuring the size? Is it increasing, decreasing? What's the trend with it? It's been around for maybe 20, 30 years, no?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, actually, it has been increasing, and because we used to say it's the size of Massachusetts, and now it's the size of New Jersey. That change, I think, came. That's a very unscientific way of describing the size of it, but at least it's easy.
It probably isn't shaped like it.
Right, but it's easy to understand, and if you think about it, if New Jersey were a dead zone, we'd be doing something about it. You know, it's part of our country. You know, our country is mostly water. Since the expansion of our territorial limits out 200 miles, we are an ocean nation, but we don't hold it in the same regard that we do the land, and we really should.
Is that because we don't know it? We haven't explored it?
I think that's part of it.
Haven't swum in it.
I think that's also part of it is we kind of take it for granted, too. We don't feel that personal connection. Sometimes we feel it's the domain of the fisherman and the oil man, but not of us, except maybe at the beach. Mm-hmm. And the ocean kind of suffers from a pretty face, too. Many of us would be outraged if we could see underwater to see what's actually going on down there. But if you're down at the shore and, you know, putting on the suntan lotion and looking out at the waves, it looks pretty nice.
Until you get under it. Well, we're almost out of time here. And as you say, most of the undersea, underwater world is unexplored. Is there a place that you want to go to that you haven't been to?
Well,
and there are probably plenty of places you haven't been to, but nonetheless.
I'm a bit addicted, as Dr. Sylvia Earle is, to the deep places. And believe it or not, we've only been to the deepest part of the oceans once, and that was more than 50 years ago. So I would definitely like to go to the Challenger Deep, down to the deepest part of the oceans, and turn on the lights and see who's home down there.
Wow. And how deep is that?
That is 7 miles down.
Oh, my goodness.
That's pretty deep.
Yeah. Well, you need more than just that submarine that you've been using, right?
Yes, we need some new technology. But ironically, there are only a handful of subs that can go half of that distance. So we've got some work to do.
Well, David Guggenheim, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. And I should say he's going to be receiving an award for his scientific research on coral reefs from the International Exploration Society. That's Philadelphia today. And then tomorrow he's going to be giving a public lecture at Friends Select School on the Parkway in Philadelphia. Obviously joined us today on Radio Times to talk about our oceans and some of his adventures underwater. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. And you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscow, and thank you for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times.